Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Before the big interview begins, I want to remind you that we're now producing over 8 hours of advert-free podcasts every month for our socios at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. For just £2.99 per month, you get a weekly magazine show, extra socio-only big interviews, plus documentary specials. And when you sign up, you get instant access to the entire archive. Enjoy the show. Hello, football fans. Welcome to another big interview. This time, it's with the wonderful Terry Gibson. I know Terry well, and I'd consider him a friend. Also, he is, without doubt, one of the best analytical eyes on televised football anywhere in Britain. You listen to him talking about La Liga in his co-commentaries, and you will learn he's consistently articulate, bright-eyed, and worth listening to. But it wasn't for friendship or analysis that I chose him. Terry had a smashing career. Brilliantly talented man. He coped with the ups and downs, won the FA Cup, played for Manchester United, helped coach Northern Ireland to a victory over Spain that changed the entire history of modern European football. He was a lightning fast forward. There were matches that if you could take them and bottle them up, would be as good as any forward has experienced over the last 20, 30 years. But he's a right character too. Funny about his career, and fascinating to listen to. For example, in part one of this big interview, Terry explains what or who scared him most when he was coming through at Spurs. He describes what it was like to play in the infamous Friday kick-ups at Spurs. They were brutal games which took place the day before big first team matches, and he speaks honestly about how it felt to leave the club that he's always supported. In fact, he's always loved. Terry is always very, very funny. But there's still frustration in his voice as he recounts a trying time at Manchester United under Ron Atkinson and then under Sir Alex Ferguson, a manager with whom Terry did have a massive fallout before patching it up and then moving on to have big success, finally at Wimbledon. Terry, you're extremely excited right now, and it's not simply because we're sharing a table again after so long apart at Sky and covering La Liga. You're excited because you're a Spurs man, through and through and through, am I right?
Yes, very much so.
And therefore, times right now look kind of sweet?
Yeah, and it's kind of weird, you know. I've kind of reflected back over my life as a Spurs fan because I grew up as a Spurs fan. My dad was a Spurs fan, my uncles, my cousins, that's who I went to watch Spurs with on a regular basis, and used to carry a milk crate into the ground to stand. All the kids had a milk crate that they could put at the front of the terraces, so everybody passed the kids through. There was all these milk crates, so I used to be right near the trainer's bench with the old West Stand, so you could see who was in the trainer's bench.
So you could see over the wall?
Exactly, or? Yeah. So
because this is terracing. For those who don't remember terracing.
Pay on the day, queue up, went to games where you couldn't get in because it was sold out. Sold out, Simon was up.
What would you do if you turned up as a youngster and you couldn't get in? Would you sit and wait for the roar outside? Because you couldn't go and watch it on Sky.
No, and there was a big gate outside White Hart Lane on the main entrance. So it led to that, it stopped you getting to the terraces. So it would take quite a while before you realised that the queue wasn't moving anymore, and then the sold out sign went up and everyone jeered and off they went. So you're talking about 50 odd, 60,000 in White Hart Lane, which before it was knocked down was down to 30 odd. So it was great. But I grew up idolising Spurs players. I was kind of forced into Jimmy Greaves because it was just a bit before when I started watching. It was
rather
Chivers
than
and
see
Gilzean,
you were taught about him.
Yeah, and when I say Foulkes, I was encouraged by my dad. Yeah. That was the player that he, you know, wanted me to be like, because he was quite small, and I was even at a young age. It was clear I wasn't going to be a six footer. But my recollection is watching Chivers, Gilzean, Alan Mallory, Phil Beale, people like that. That
Cyril Knowles.
Cyril, yeah,
nice
yeah,
one, Cyril.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, Pat Jennings in goal, of course. So I grew up idolising Spurs, and then getting the opportunity to go to Spurs, and then getting what I believed at the time discarded by Spurs. For the rest of my football career, probably I've spent the entire length of it trying to prove Spurs wrong, when really there was no need. It was just I was young and fired up, a bit of fire in my belly that, you know, I wanted to stay longer. That didn't happen. So for the rest of your career, you sort of fired up against Spurs every time you played them. And then it was kind of nice to go back to being a fan again after all that. You know, when you're playing against the team you support, it kind of you do lose that element of supporting that club. Even when I was, you know, playing for Coventry, that was my first club when I left Spurs. A week later, we were playing at White Hart Lane. I was so fired up, it was ridiculous. And I remember Steve Perriman talking about years later about I was like,
did you leave a couple
possessed
on him?
Not on Steve, I wouldn't, no. But I was fired up. And that went on for a long period of my career. So you kind of lose that love, which was sad, mm-hmm. but you can't have it. If you're a professional and you're playing against them, and you're competing against them, and you know, particularly for one or two of the clubs I played for, which were deemed to be smaller, so like Coventry and Wimbledon, when you go and play White Lane, it's one of the bigger games of the season, and you're the underdog, and you've got to be fired up. So, and Wimbledon and Tottenham had a weird relationship. So it was kind of nice when I stopped playing to then pick up my love of Spurs again.
Which right now must be reaching a peak, because we're not going to stop at the modern Spurs for very long, but the brand of football that you're seeing, the emergence of some, if not local boys, some English fellas in the team again, the type of manager that you've got, a rebuilding of a stadium, a gradual progress that takes you to Champions League and comfortably beating the holders, but at Wembley. Right now, isn't the worst time to be a Spurs lover.
No, but the nature of a Spurs fan lover is you're always looking for the worst. And the Real Madrid game was a classic. Listening to the commentary, we were 3-0 up with 25, 30 minutes to go. And the commentary, Steve McManaman was on co-coms and I think Ian Dark.
Ian Dark, yeah.
And it was all over with 30 minutes to go. It was like the next 20 minutes was just talking about this fantastic victory for Spurs. And you know as well as I do that the Real Madrid, if any team, have got it in them to get...
It could have happened.
It could have happened.
So you're sitting chewing your nails.
Oh, for God's sake. It was just your typical Spurs fan. I'm sitting there thinking, I nearly turned the sound down because I was getting wound up about it. And then when they scored, then they had another little spell about 5 minutes after where they could have got the second. Then I was thinking, this is... But thankfully, Spurs held on.
Every silver lining has a cloud, is what you're saying.
Yes, that's just the nature of a Spurs fan. I always thought Man City supporters used to be the same.
Oh, well, yeah.
But they're not now.
They've earned it. They've earned it a little bit. They've had their years.
So it's nice to be supporting a club who I believe have done things in their own way, in the right way. And
so let me give you a proposition, because everybody talks about, I don't know, Harry Kane and Pochettino and... They might even mention Dele Alli, White Hart Lane's being rebuilt. If you've got any common sense, you know that Levy's a guy who's done things pretty remarkably in terms of the capacity of the crowd and therefore the revenue generation. So, very few people outside the game talk about the training ground. And what we know from every foreign journalist or player that's ever visited there, from the players I know who work there, even from Daniel Levy's partner, who's macrobiotic and he grows her vegetables at the training ground. Now that's a mark of class, I think.
Just like when I used to be.
I was going to say, Terry, let me take you back to what, 78, 79. Try and paint a picture. Where did Spurs train when you broke through?
Well, they
age
had
16?
One of the best training grounds in the country.
Ah.
Even at that time. It's only three pitches. There was no gymnasium. They had one main pitch which had a little stand. It was at Chesant, a place called Chesant. You played against other youth teams in their training grounds and nothing compared to Chesant. But it was literally three pitches, one nice pitch and a pavilion, what you would say a cricket pavilion with small changing rooms in. But it was one of the better ones.
Where then was this mythical indoor sort of hall where
that was at
there
White
were markings
Hart Lane.
On the at White Hart
yeah,
Lane.
At White Hart Lane. So we trained. The routine would be Monday to Thursday at Chesham, which is probably about 10 or 12 miles from White Hart Lane. So that was the training facility. And then on Friday morning, everybody was based at White Hart Lane. And there were two concrete gyms, concrete flooring with a five-a-side pitch marked out, brick wall, ceilings were really high, so you could whack the ball. There was no, you didn't have to go. It wasn't one of those where no overhead height, which yeah. sometimes was the rule in the games, but
yeah.
it was full on. And everybody, so you'd have the youth team, which, looking back now, the numbers-wise, before my year where I became an apprentice, they had three apprentices. So my last year at school, I became the unofficial fourth apprentice. We used to go to their school holidays, help out with the jobs. And that particular year, because there was only three apprentices, us four or five other schoolboys in our last year at school were a godsend to them because it meant they got the gym clean quicker, the kit picked up quicker, all the jobs they had.
Boots, showers.
Yep, everything. So
terraces, sweeping the terraces?
No. No, we didn't have to do that. We had to do it when it was snowing and stuff, clear the snow from the terraces, clear the snow from the pitch and stuff like that, but not in general. There was a ground staff that did that. So it was a godsend for them to have the schoolboys in the school holidays to go in and train. So the last year of my schooling, I kind of got used to that, and I hardly went to school. So I became an unpaid, unofficial fourth apprentice. So the numbers, that goes to show you, in my group, the official year I signed apprentice, there was probably seven or eight, which was a big group compared to the three that was the year before. So we didn't have, like nowadays, I'm sure there's probably 10, 12, 15 at first year, whatever they're called now, scholars, academy scholars, players. Yeah. And that goes till under 16, under 17, under 18. We had a group of 11 that covered
the whole spectrum.
So it was not a problem us being there on a Friday morning. The reserves were playing on a Saturday as well. The youth team, two youth teams. There was the under 16, under 18, but only the full-time apprentices would be at White Hart Lane on a Friday morning. And the reserves. So you had to, everyone trained at White Hart Lane in these two gyms.
Plus the first team?
Yes, first team.
Yeah.
Every single player. You had to wait to see which gym you were going to be in, whether you're going to be trained with the big boys or the reserves. Come youth team, stroke youth team in the lower ball court. They were called ball courts.
Ball courts, yeah.
And upstairs they had a little viewing gallery where when you trained there on a Tuesday and Thursday night as a schoolboy, the parents could sit and watch. So it was tradition, it was a routine, and it went back years. I mean, as a young player at Spurs, you would train at Chesham in the morning, pick up all the kit, do all the jobs, transport it all the way back to White Hart Lane, and then you would have another session in the afternoon. My stage of that, my career there, was Peter Shreves was the youth team coach, so the afternoon in the gym with Shreves, based on ball skills and stuff like that. But the Friday morning was the big coming together of everybody.
Well, you know what I'm fishing for first, which is these mythical markings on the wall that you're going to tell me which great players used them, what they were for, what they looked like, what the drills were that were demanded of you with in this ball court with the concrete floor and the brick walls. When you looked across to the other wall, what could you see and what was that there for?
Well, we had to, everything was about ball skills. There was a certain ball you used in the gym because it was going to be used constantly on concrete. And there was always, everything was based around chipping, driving the ball, certain height, certain weight on the pass. And there was, on the wall, you've got a circle, a line above the circle, and this goes all the way around the gym. So every 6 metres, whatever, there'd be a circle. There'd be a line above it, a line below it. There'd be a higher line.
Waist height, shoulder height.
And above the line, the highest line was probably about 8 foot.
Okay.
So that would be right. You've got to chip it over the top or on the white line at the top, off the wall, back onto your chest without hitting the floor, keep it up two or three times, and then a volley into the lower circle, stuff like that.
So you're aiming at, it's keep it up, chest it when it comes back off the concrete wall, which might be how far away?
We would be 15 yards away, 20 yards away.
So then,
but you'd be in the middle of the gym, so you've got another 20, someone else behind you doing it the other way.
All right.
And you'd stagger yourself.
And your volleys must go onto the white line or into the circle or what?
Into the circle.
Right.
So you chip above the white line. You can go as high as you want. So obviously the higher you go, the more chance you've got of it reaching you on a return. So you can get it on your chest control two or three times, keeping the ball up, and then look to volley it, whatever target was given. So that'd be the circle, it'd be the square, it'd be the set, the lower white line. And that would continue. That probably wouldn't be the end of the exercise. So it would be then, as it comes back to you, one touch to control, and then drive it into the other target, the square, without hitting the floor. So there was stuff like that. And there were challenges, that traditional challenges, that have been going on over the years. Our schoolboy coach was Ron Henry, who was in the famous double team. He was a fearsome character, Ron. He was another again.
Hero of your dad. And
hero
of
my dad, yeah. And
by you being passed down of yours until you meet him. And
he frightened the life out of me. I remember I went to Spurs. I went to a few clubs. I was invited to go and train with a few clubs. And my first training session at Spurs, I was actually injured. I had what they call oscus latus, which is a, believe it or not, something to do with a growing disorder. They're seen as a...
I'm not going to bite.
No, it was kind of strange that I got
all my life in Spain. I've worked with Messi, and you and Messi are about identical height, so it'll do for me.
The resemblance ends there. And it was to do with the growing of the knee and the shin bone and stuff like that, and overplaying. So, yeah, like most boys my age, I don't think I was overplaying. But it could be nowadays. I play for a Saturday team, a Sunday team, trained at Tottenham Tuesday and Thursday, played for my school, played for my district, played for representative teams in the leagues that I played in on Saturday and Sunday morning, Waltham Forest, played for Essex, played for London, played for England schoolboys, all between the age of 13 and 15. So you were playing and training every day. So when I went to Spurs, they asked me to go, and I said, I've got this, been to see an osteopath because I wasn't tied to a club, and I had this, which was quite common at the time. So when they said, come down and have treatment, they wanted me to go and they wanted to get to know me and stuff. So the first time I walked in, Ron Henry was there, and I went in the change room and I said, he said, who are you? There was no...
Welcome,
I'd been
Spurs.
Courted by this scout, a bloke called Dickie Walker, who was like a legendary chief scout at Spurs. He was chief scout, was the only scout, and he did everything. First team players, reserves. He found everybody that went to Spurs. So he was a close pal of Eddie Bailey and Bill Nicholson, and everything went through Dickie Walker. And Dickie, I said, oh, Dickie Walker sent me down. I don't care, what were you doing here? What are you doing? Where's your kit? I said, I've come down for treatment. You make me laugh, you're not even training. First time you've come down here and you're
writing about
walking and coming for treatment. He had no idea. He didn't care. It was, and I kind of get what he was thinking. He's probably got 20 kids to train that particular night, schoolboys.
But on the day,
one
you
turns
were,
up.
On the day, what you're feeling understanding, or you're
oh no, no, I was scared. Yeah, I was like, oh no, try to explain. My dad had dropped me off. My dad wasn't in the change room at the time. Try to explain, and then thankfully Dickie Walker came in and said to Ron, no, this is the boy I told you about. And we can look after him. I'm going to have a look at him in the next few weeks. But so it was. We had this Ron Henry, who'd done all these skills probably 20 years before. And these traditions are still the same, markings are still on the wall. And he would tell us this record and that record. And the name that seemed to have every record was Dave McKay.
I was hoping you would say
every single record, Dave McKay. Now, my image of Dave McKay was this tough tackling, no-nonsense, leader-type player that was loved, revered at Spurs and at Derby County. And as I got older, I did see him on television, mainly for Derby County, not so much for Spurs, and recognising that this wonderfully talented leader-type personality, then to find out that he was the legend.
So skilled.
And, exactly, in touch and technique and stuff like that. So Dave McKay was always the target. So we would be given these challenges that if Dave McKay could do it, you could do it. Ron Henry could do stuff that we couldn't do.
Still at that age?
15 and 16, yes. He would do everything perfect and so easy. So he would demonstrate, this is what I want you to do, and he'd do it. And
when you watch some kids, I don't want to name names, but you watch some kids who break through in the Premier League now, do you think if you took them back to that gym, they could do those skills? I'm asking because I see a lot of runners and jumpers and
athletes. Yeah, we had a lot of players at the time that I came through that were similar in terms of, if you looked at the chipping technique of someone like Glenn Hoddle, and then it was Mickey Hazard, and it was Ian Crook, three players that were really skillful, different. Glenn was obviously, and Mickey and Ian Crook would agree, was clearly the best. But the way they chipped the ball, the technique they used, it was so similar. And we were all capable of driving the ball waist height to a player 20 yards away. We were all capable of chipping it into someone's chest 20 yards away. You're all capable of controlling it on your chest and your first touch. And you see that the way that Glenn Hoddle controlled the chest control would be similar to other players that came through Spurs at that time. So, I mean, I loved it. It was dreamland, didn't you?
Anybody listening to this who loves football would be thinking that is dreamland, because not only are you at the club you love, but, you know, you're talking about doing skills that are a test, they're fun. You're setting yourself against the guy who's next to you, who's to your right, who's behind you. And it's that competitive urge that when you're a kid, you try and kick the ball off a lamppost or a tree or
put it
through somebody's window and pretend it was a mistake. And you're doing that for a living.
And we did it. So we would train in the morning at Chesham. So we'd get to White Hart Lane first, load all the kit up on the minibus. We had three or four players each who were responsible for getting their kit ready, cleaning their boots, rolling their kit up in a towel.
Who were yours?
I was really lucky.
Go on.
Well, I signed officially apprentice in the summer of 79. So July, August.
Aged 16 or 15?
I was 16.
16, yeah.
And I was professional by December. I played in the first team in 3 months. So I didn't have a long apprenticeship. But I did the jobs for another 2 years, unofficially.
Voluntary? Or was it expected just to keep
your
feet in the ground?
I wouldn't have dared to have not done them. So instead of 16 quid a week, I was getting 80 quid a week.
But still polishing boots and washing strips.
Yeah. So you'd get to White Hart Lane early in the morning, fight over the kit, literally, because there was ankle socks and long socks and players had preferences. And if you didn't get the right socks, then you got to bollock him when you got to the other end. You'd go forward to taking the ankle socks out of someone else's and putting them in. So it was good fun. So that was probably about 8 o'clock up our state. Then we go to Chesham on the minibus, train there, do all the same jobs afterwards, collect all the stuff up, back on the minibus, back to White Hart Lane, bit of lunch in a cafe around the corner.
We'll come to Tony's cafe in a minute.
And we had an allowance, probably, I think it was 80 pence a day allowance for your dinner. And it coped. It did the job. Ham, egg and chips, stuff like that. Train in the gym. Then we'd have other jobs to do. And then you'd find us back in the gym.
There.
So this is probably 5 o'clock where we'd finished. You're in your civvies because you've changed, showered, done your jobs, and then back up there. And some of the older pros. So above my age group was people like Mark Falco, Gary Brook. They would be waiting, hanging around for us to go back in the gym. Then we would literally get thrown out. And all the time we were doing these... We wasn't just messing around. Doing the skills. It was hitting the crossbar, hitting the white line, chest control. And it was just a question of all the time being driven on by wanting to achieve what others had achieved and not be embarrassed, because there was an element of fear. If Ron Henry told you to do this particular skill, he would look over you and watch. And the pressure at 14 and 15 and 16 or whatever, if you couldn't do it...
Hugely embarrassing,
And then when you train him in the pros, they would pair you up. So you wouldn't pick your own pairs, and then suddenly you find yourself chipping a ball to Glenn Hoddle, and he doesn't want a chip that doesn't go on his chest. So you've got to be...
Ball's got to come right there.
It's got to be where he wants it, yeah. Not because he was the type of bloke that would give you a bollocking if he didn't, but you just didn't want to be...
If you're competitive, you make sure your level's right.
If you didn't get the first one right, the pressure's on the second one, and then perhaps if you did three or four that weren't as Glenn wanted, or... Ozzy Ardiles or Steve Herman, if it wasn't wanted, then they might...
You'd be moved on at very least.
Yeah, they'd let you know. Body language, they wouldn't come across and rant and rave in your face, but it was a lovely environment to be
right,
brought up.
You've set this up beautifully, the old storyteller, you. So we're talking about technique, we're talking about skill, we're talking about sort of a sort of round table, a King Arthur's table of technique, and it was a lovely environment. So now tell me about the Friday kick-up.
Well, it was lethal. It was, you got this
so from lovely environment to lethal.
Yes, and then the programme would be 20 minutes probably of these chipping, different techniques, bit of a whoop. That was to be like a warm-up. And then a game, which is probably a nine-a-side. It's probably the size of the ball court upstairs was probably a quarter of a football pitch.
Right. If concrete floor.
Concrete still. Floor, brick wall. Ball, so the ball never goes out of play. There's no fouls. So you can be smashed up against the brick wall. The last place you wanted to be was trapped in the corner with the ball in there. And
you take a kicking.
Yes. And you had some competitive guys in there. Really competitive. And it was important to win the games. It was important not to miss chances that came your way. By and large, it would be two-touch, one-touch finish. And people would want to take the piss as well. So if you was one of the skillful players, I'm not going to name names because it's easy to identify who they were at the time at Spurs. I already spoke about some of them. But in every team, there's skillful players and there's a balance of players that know how to win a game of football. And that counted on a Friday morning. It was exactly the same. So you'd have the ones that want to take the mick. Aussie, Glenn loved the nutmegs. There was other players, Alfie Conn, Neil McNabb. I remember Mickey Hazard, of course, he loved the nutmegs. That was all that mattered
all
to them.
Ball players.
That's all that mattered. Then you would have your other players that were determined to win.
Firm players.
Firm senior players that didn't want the piss taken out of them. And there was no nutmegging this player or that player. And no one would try and nutmeg Terry Naylor or Steve Perriman or John Pratt. But, you know, the ones that wanted to take liberties tried to.
Might have a go every now and again and
oh,
try.
Oh, yeah.
It.
And count them. I was never a big fan of nutmegging people. I got nutmegged. I didn't care. I threw myself in and committed, went on my arse and slid in and got nutmegged. And it never bothered me. And it never bothered me nutmegging others. But for some players, and to this day, people still, some
it's
players
a trophy, it's a state
love,
symbol.
Love a nutmeg. Yeah. And in that environment, where everyone was no shin pads, for 20 minutes, no stoppages, because the ball never goes out of play, it was all hell would break. I got hit. Probably most Fridays got a right-hander.
A punch?
Yes, on a Friday afternoon.
Not always from the same person.
Oh, no, the list was endless. And I deserved it. I mean, I was...
And I know that you're kind of like a football Boutros Ghali, a peacemaker and a bringer of love and joy, but you might occasionally have hooked back.
I had small man syndrome right throughout my playing career.
Talk
because it was... There were issues. I was fortunate. Tottenham was one of the places where they had encouraged me to fill out because when I made my debut, I was 17 years.
You were really slender, weren't you?
I was 9 stone.
Yeah.
And the same height, 5'4". So I was encouraged then to fill out, but they never really made it clear to me that if I didn't, I wouldn't make it. It was for my benefit.
Okay.
So there was never a... concern that they thought I would be too small to make it as a player, or so it was always encouragement. So
sensational.
I did that, and it was ridiculous. The diet was drink Guinness. I was 16. It was eat steak. We probably couldn't afford steak too often, if I'm being honest. And my 16 quid a week wasn't going to get too many steaks. So it was kind of left to our own devices. My dad built me some weights that I could use at home and chest expander. I had a sandbag that I used to do leg raises on. Lay on the floor and do for my quads, which my quads eventually become huge, so that helped. But my dad had two wheels from a lorry, and he had an iron bar welded to the two wheels. So you imagine big lorry wheels without the tyres on.
They're flipping gigantic.
And a big pole, a big iron bar in the middle, a round bar.
Yeah.
That was in my bedroom. So I would come home and Dad would say, have you done your squats and done your sandbags with your leg raises and stuff like that? So there was a gym at Spurs, but I've seen pictures of 30 years before that, the same gym, the same equipment. It wasn't a big issue at Tottenham and most clubs.
Because it was ball work first or?
Yeah, probably people didn't realise they expected of every player that they would be strong enough. And if he wasn't strong enough, it was your own responsibility to be strong enough.
Okay.
If he wasn't strong enough, then you weren't going to be any good to anybody. So it was just get on with it yourself, really.
Were you learning Walthamstow in the Indies?
Yeah.
So I know the bus driver from the sort of... White Hart Lane, Walthamstow route, and cauliflower ears, black eyes, busted nose on the way
home.
Yeah,
we had this sand. When we finished in the gym on a Friday, one of the jobs was to sweep the gym. Mm. And because it was impossible, because you'd sweep it, the dust would go up in the air and come straight back on the floor. So they gave us sand, big bags of sand, to pour out in the gym. And you each went up and down this length of this ball court with a brushing technique, moving it 6 inches at a time, so it would trap the dust, and you then collected all the sand back up at the end. I'm thinking, as I'm talking about now, I'm thinking, on what planet is that?
I said Keith Burton Show was up in the balcony having a right good
laugh. Yeah, it was every Friday we did.
Go on, Lance.
So I used to get this black stuff in your mouth and your nose and stuff like that. And so having got a smack in the mouth from one of the senior players or any, it could have been someone my own age, if you just rattled someone and you got an elbow in the face or a right, literally, you know, right-hander. Going home on the bus afterwards with a black eye and a fat lip and the black stuff coming out my nose. And then playing on Saturday morning.
Well, I was going to say, luckily, this was, you know, several days before the big game. But
no.
See, I mean...
And to finish on a Friday, so we had the warm-up with the chipping technique. We then had the kick-up and then sprints on the cinder around the Barton Lane pitch.
Yeah.
So everyone would then finish with the sprints, and that was competitive again. And being quick, that was one of my... I can stand out here now. I might not be the best at chipping and stuff. And the sprints would be 20 yards max, and you'd probably do another 10, 15 minutes to sharpen up. And I always thought then that's how everybody was going to be on a Friday morning. Mm. It was perfect. You did the chipping, the technique, the skills. You did the kick-up, and then you finished with the sprints, and you felt alive on a Friday afternoon, sharp, ready to go on Saturday.
Ted Butcher once told us in this series... Great story about the gravel, red gravel pitch opposite Ibrox when Graham Souness was the manager and it was England, Scotland.
Yeah.
And he said it just went off. He said there was no hold bars. Yeah. His description was a little bit like yours, you know, when you said that the thing was lethal. And we both know that if that was tried at any club today, you know, nobody would buy into it. It'd be this, you know, it'd be on the Sunday papers back page.
Yeah.
Immediately, yeah. Youngsters would cry off. People wouldn't go to that club. Literally,
and it's the bollocking you took from the older players. There was, at the time, and even now, they weren't wrong. They stood you in good stead.
Mm.
But if you gave the ball away in a practice session and someone, you know, would, I mean, Terry Nailis made me cry in my first reserve game because I was 15 years old playing with Terry Nailis. He's one of my players that I was watching and I gave the ball away on the halfway line because I was trying to be clever. And he ripped into me and I had a lump in my throat. My eyes were teared up, 15 years old.
Natural.
And spent the next 20 minutes not probably being able to see the ball properly and trying to... I'm not upset. Yes, I am. And
you wouldn't want to do it again.
I gave the ball away for the rest of my career on the halfway line when I was trying to be too clever and I could hear Terry Naylor effing and blinding at me. And that would be on a daily basis. So I don't think it's wrong. I didn't think it was wrong then.
No.
It was uncomfortable. No one liked... to have it done to them. And I certainly don't think it would be wrong now. It might make you young players feel uncomfortable.
But it couldn't happen, could it? I mean, I'm not asking it to turn the clock back, because clearly there are some things about... Just one example, you know, somebody goes in hard, you know, there's no fouls, the next game is Arsenal, it's 24 hours away, somebody's, you know, leg gets broken, or their ankle gets turned, and it's because there was a Friday kick-up. In the modern game, nobody would accept that.
No, they wouldn't. No.
It's more question than statement.
Joe, I can't recollect that actually happening in the end where someone got injured on the Friday kick-up and missed the game on the Saturday. It was bizarre. Didn't happen.
Your parting statement in this
season. I mean, you're talking about the first team could be having a big game the next day and someone's levering into Glenn Oddle and Ozzy Ardiles on a Friday morning.
Could Ozzy or Glenn handle it?
Glenn could handle it with the skill, and Ozzy could look after himself physically as well. He knew... self-preservation, has he?
He's a hell of a man, isn't he?
Yeah.
Let's talk about those exotic birds, because when we were chatting, just privately setting this up, one of the things that you liked was that apart from playing with your heroes that you've been watching, or been trained by a hero of your dad and a double winner, you know, it was a very local side. And London was a really different city then. A bit more wide, a bit less... homogenised and corporate, and
definitely.
You had to know your way around, but also it kind of everybody knew each other. And you said that even when Ricky Hazard came down from, you know, Sunderland, it was like, whoa, who's this strange creature?
Yeah, and it must have been tough for him as
For him. But then two Argentinians turn up.
I know. What? Yeah, it was a rarity to have a Welsh player or a Scottish player or a player from Sunderland like Ricky Hazard coming down and spending time at a club, and it was on the two aliens.
These are really Welsh. These are very Welsh, these two.
South America that we'd only seen in late at night when you were fortunate enough to watch the World Cup that summer. And then they turn up with a ticker tape welcome. And it was interesting, actually, because they've not long been relegated. before that. And there was a big turnaround at the club, and Keith Birkinshaw became the manager. And Keith really did change clubs, and people didn't probably give him credit at that time, because it took a while for everything to materialise and the end results. One of those was the youth team, the schoolboys, hence the reason the year before me there was only three apprentices. In my year there was eight, and that got up to scratch again. Keith would be on the team bus, the coach, on a Sunday morning, travelling with us as 14 and 15-year-olds, going off to play at Colchester or whatever club we were playing with. It was long journeys with Colchester, that's why I picked them out, Southend. We would play
Southern Counties League.
Yeah, Keith would be on the bus with his wife on a Sunday morning after the first team game on a Saturday. He got to know the parents, he got to know all of us and took a real interest. So that was the first sort of thing he did. And then, of course, the club got back in the top division, and then Keith had the vision that no one else had at the time. I'm sure Ozzy in particular was offered to other clubs. But Keith was the one that had the guts to go ahead with it. And then, of course, the ridiculous story that Ozzy said, would you be interested in my mate? And that was Ricky.
It's as simple as that,
yeah. But Harry Haslam, the ex-Sheffield United manager, had contacts in Sabella.
Because Alex Sabella had joined, hadn't he?
Yeah, there was that sort of connection somewhere, and the connection between Harry Haslam and Keith. Maybe one or two other managers that didn't fancy the idea of Ozzy Ardiles, South American, coming in and playing in the English league. But Keith had that. It was something he suddenly thought straight away. I was with him recently, and he admitted straight away he knew Ozzy as the player. And thought it was a great idea. And then when Ozzy said, oh, but it was just literally as easy as that. Would you be interested in my mate?
I've got this fellow who I know
he was
who
in
plays.
The World Cup. And the funny thing with Ricky is his main impact in that World Cup was doing someone, kicking someone. And he socks down, long beard, long hair. For all intents and purposes, a typical hatchet man midfielder.
You wouldn't mess with him.
No. And then Ricky turns up and didn't want to make a tackle for 6 months. It was the only tackle in his entire career that he'd ever done like that. And everybody thought, we've signed Ricky to protect Ozzy. That's, you know, great. Ozzy's the skillful one. He's the little fella. Ricky's the big, strong fella that's going to look after him. And it probably was the other way around. But the image everybody had of Ricky wasn't too much footage other than this tackle. But he was a strong guy, and once he realised that he had to be physical and be stronger, but clearly his strength, Ricky, was his skill. But I spoke to Ozzy at length over what it was like for them when they turned up, and they didn't have much knowledge of Tottenham Hotspur. They knew it was in London. Didn't have much knowledge of other teams in the division. No knowledge, of course, of any of the players at Tottenham Hotspur. No knowledge of the area, so they were, Ozzy said, they went to training, someone drove them 2 or 3 days in to Cheshunt, and then they got cars delivered. They had local sponsored cars.
Jags, Merckx?
One was an Austin Allegro and one was an Austin Princess. I've seen the pictures of it looks great. And they're being presented with these cars, and then everyone left, and Ozzy and Ricky had no idea whether to go left or right outside the train room back to where they lived. It was just literally, there was no care whatsoever. Yeah, but they were signed, now get on with it, find your own way home. And find.
Do you think they did drive around, like, North London?
They must have done, yeah. They must have done. And so there was Exactly, just can't imagine it. But it was great for us. It was my last year at the school year, which I'd never went to school in, apart from to play games for the school. That was an arrangement we had, that I would go and play school football matches and spend the rest of the time.
Turned out all right.
Yeah, it was a bad decision, but it's worked out in hindsight. And so I was there on a regular basis when they turned up, and it was just, there was a little bit of resentment, I think, from the other players. Just got promoted, and then you got two foreigners coming in, South Americans coming in, and they had all the publicity, and clearly they were going to get the publicity. And then the interest from everywhere on Tottenham Hotspur, because of Ozzy and Ricky, sort of, it didn't take long before the players realised how good they were. And
fantastic
love
fellas,
it.
Aren't
yeah.
they?
So it took probably a week.
But their English wouldn't have been...
That was non-existent.
Yeah.
But Ozzy learned to swear pretty quickly. Swears too much now.
I can't believe we haven't rehearsed this, because I was the first time I ever met him, we were down in somewhere in southwest London, one of these cricket green village thingies where the pub sits in the corner. And he was on his way to West Ham to do something or other. And I was having lunch I can't remember who it was. Maybe it might even have been Mark Bolton. And Ozzy turns up to the table, and it's about lunchtime, and he has a drink, and his language is, I thought, I found my brother. Because everybody tells me that my language is atrocious. It's like, I've just been outsworn by Ozzy.
Well, you look at, we had these two Argentinians that both smoking in the changing room before games at half time on the team bus, which was driving players mad. They had the shortest shorts that you could possibly imagine, and then they tied their boots up around their ankles. So, as young players, we're all looking and thinking, should I start smoking? I'm going to roll my shorts up. I'll start with that. And I love the way Ozzy ties his. If you look at the original pictures when Ozzy came in.
The laces just keep coming up above.
Yeah, up the socks. So they, instead of we were underneath the boot or then become the trend just to tie, why are we going underneath the boot? I don't know why we ever did that, wrapping it round about five times.
Not
to Ozzy and Ricky tying it up round their ankle and up their sock. And tying
it's
a bow
even support,
halfway up
it?
Their
it's
shin.
Not, it's, I don't know what that is.
It looked good though. It did. You had the Mario Kempesh and Ozzy Ardiles and the other South Americans with the ankle laces tied up. It looked the part. And it was useless. It was utterly useless, so in terms of keeping your boot on.
Yeah. And Ozzy's first word would have been nuts.
Because he liked a nutmeg, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was a genius, he was. Some of the things he was telling me, one of them still I'm not sure is possible, that when he was taking a defender on, and I think it must be, I can't fathom it out. I couldn't work it out. He gave me advice that when he was running at a defender and the defender was facing him and backing off, he would look for a particular split second where a certain foot would be planted as that player was running back to then knock the ball past him. Can't do it.
Because the balance, once he's gone, the guy's balance is such that he's
got
an extra advantage.
Exactly. Yeah. And Ozzy tried to advise me. I'm still not sure that's possible.
But he's I mean,
because when you look, you've got the ball at your feet, you're looking at the defender, you're probably looking at the upper half of his body.
But some of us have to look, and others, I'm not giving a veritas automatically to Ozzy, but you and I both know that in life as well, he's a very, very intelligent man.
Extremely.
And he was a lawyer, and his dad was furious that he,
grandmaster
stupid football, chess. You flipping idiot, and, you know, never mind your World Cup, grandmaster at chess. A bright man. Some people, you know, you've spent your latter life commentating on Isco and Iniesta and Xavi and Messi, and you kind of know that some people
different.
Just sense it.
Yeah, I tried it. I tried it in training, but I couldn't get my head down looking at the ball and the player's feet. My head was always...
And coordinating.
Looking at the upper...
The shove of the ball and moving.
Yeah,
the
upper part of the body and knowing... When that player stepped back onto his left foot as he was manoeuvring backwards, then I could go on the right because his left foot. It was that sort of theory behind what he was telling us, but it was extremely hard to do. But I trust Ozzy could do it because you used to see him on a regular basis.
The player
knock it past players, and the arm used to come out in their face, and that was it. He was gone, and no stopping him.
He was tough as well. He was
street smart. Similar to me. He was Ozzy's probably a couple of inches taller than me, so he's probably 5'6".
But toothpick thin as well.
Yes, no, he wasn't as big as me.
Really slender.
And he knew how to look after himself. And he had to, because at that stage, English football, you were inclined that it was possible to kick players.
Let's go on one of his nights. Let's go one of his nights. Where were you in, I suppose it was January 1980?
Yes, it was, yeah.
January 1980, FA Cup, third round replay. Old Trafford, 53,762 spectators.
Do we have to describe what a replay is? For your younger listeners.
Yes, all right.
Probably. And we used to have more than
one. Does this mean you scored in the 1-1 draw? Was that 1-1 draw?
No, it was 1-1 on the Saturday, and this would have been midweek. So 3 days later, we didn't have to wait 10 days.
Had you played in the first game?
Yep, my debut was 29th of December against Stoke.
A calm affair.
Yep.
No kicking or fighting or scratching
Rip
or pulling. Mike Doyle.
I got a reputation in from day one. Mm. And then a part of that was I wanted to play in the next game. And I thought, if I'd been picked to play in this one, there was one or two injury issues. But by and large, the team weren't scoring. So I was given the go-ahead to have a crack. And I knew we had Manchester United the week later at Wild Lane in the FA Cup. So that was my first target. Played well against Stoke. We won 1-0. Then selected for the next game, which was Manchester United at Wild Lane. It was an interesting experience because it was there was a little bit of fear in the game before the game. We had the fences up at Wyatt Lane at that time. It's 50-odd thousand. Mm. Crowd trouble was pretty bad. I'm 17 and a week.
It was the norm. And when we talk about crowd trouble, we are talking about...
This was more than the norm.
Punches and fights and bottles and bricks. And it was the full old...
Getting in amongst each other and taking an end and taking a side and all that stuff. You know,
anybody who's grown up with the Premier League only just has literally no idea what we're talking about.
No. And we had, the fences were to stop people getting on the pitch because there was a period where it was all happening on the pitch as well. Yeah. And then the fences came down. And
this was North versus South. This was Manchester United Spurs.
Yes.
Neither of us is praising
it
up.
A week after my 17th birthday, 5 months since leaving school, and the warm-up before the game, I'm knocking the ball around, and Steve Perriman come across, and I think he knew, and he said, are you OK? And I was like looking at like the damage that was going on a few yards away from me behind the...
Because people are battering each other pre-game.
Yeah. So that it was a big event, of course, but it wasn't, if I'm being honest, the 80s, when I weren't a great time, the spectacle of playing football, there was periods where it wasn't on television, there was periods where we had the fences, and
we had two disasters.
So
disasters.
It wasn't a glamorous period for English football. But playing at Man United and Spurs is a glamorous affair.
But at that stage, I imagine, as a footballer, in your case, you'd seen it enough to accept it, and okay, with Steve Perriman's help, you just get on with it, no?
Yeah, but it's hard. It takes a while. It took a while to get you. I was a kid, you know, and you're looking around and you're seeing bad trouble, bad violence.
That's interesting. You're
20 minutes before kickoff.
The first pro I've heard.
You go out and you've got a spring in your step. You're doing this warm up, no team warm up. You go out and flick a ball about and just get used to the atmosphere. And of course, 6 months before, I'm standing in the same place where the crowd are singing your name and it's all kicking off, and it was volatile. It was
potentially you had mates in there that day,
or? Yeah, family, mates, yeah, in the same places where I used to stand, cousins, uncles and stuff. And it was just like, this is not a reserve game with 1500 people in, or a youth team game at Cheshunt. This is 50 odd thousand, and in that particular day they were trying to tear each other apart. So it was, but once I got over that pretty quick, Steve Perriman was captain and legend, he come over and sort of calmed you, concentrate. I think it was more of a...
Get a head straight.
Yeah, concentrate on the game. And we drew, so 3 days later we've got the replay at Old Trafford and picked to play again. It was the dynamic duo, me and Gerry Armstrong up front.
They're...
Okay, who'd have thought?
We'll come to Gerry in a minute.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
United in them days were Gary Bailey, Martin Buchan, Stuart Houston, Jimmy Nicol, Gordon McQueen, Stevie Coppell, Mickey Thomas, Ray Wilkins, Sammy McElroy, Joe Jordan and Lou McCarrie.
Yeah.
You know, a decent 11 there.
Yeah.
A decent 11 there. And the side that Spurs line up is Aleksić, Houghton, Don McAllister, Paul Miller, Steve Perriman, Osvaldo Ardiles, Glenn Hoddle, Ricky Villa, Terry Yorath, Gerry Armstrong and Terry Gibson. And what happens?
You got to remember, there's only one sub per team then.
Who's John Pratt?
Yeah, and you would usually use them as an impact or emergency, of course, if injury, emergency. So your reluctant managers were reluctant to use the subs, and this, you were 1-0 down with 10 minutes to go, and that's where we had the players that become known as super subs. And what happened in this particular game was, we're playing at Old Trafford, the Stretford in 60-odd thousand, it probably was. Midweek, it was on sports night, no live, so the highlights were going to be on later on television. And the ball goes into the box, and Joe Jordan goes up for a header with Milo Alexic. Cleans him out. I mean, and what you've got to remember is, we as players, we only see, yep, see an aerial collision. It didn't look any different to. When you see the replay, you see exactly what happens. It's a clear elbow. It was, even by those standards, when centre forwards were expected to go and challenge goalkeepers in that manner, it was an awful collision. Elbow was out, straight into Amelia's jaw as he's mid air, fractured his jaw and cheekbone, and it was all over the place in the eye socket. What we didn't realise, though, there was, because he got knocked out in the air, when he landed, his knee spun round.
Yeah, okay.
And he done his cruciate knee ligament. So the initial response was to a player that was severely unconscious and his face was a mess. But you're looking at, you're not thinking who's going to go and go, are we going to win this game? You've got a teammate who's in a bad way. And then it was...
What do we do now?
It was ages to go. There was a long time to go in that game as well.
Yeah, I'd say it's...
Because we went into extra time as well.
20-something minutes.
So we're thinking, no plan here, who's going to go and go? And Glenn is then, of all players, Glenn's fighting as Mealy is being stretched off. There's not even a replacement goalkeeping jersey. So Glenn's... pulling this jersey off of Milo Alexic as he's unconscious and could be a neck injury or anything.
I'd forgotten.
We were having, give us your shirt and gloves. And Glenn, I'd not seen Glenn in goal before.
Was he mad keen to go in?
Really mad keen to go in.
What was that about?
I had no idea. And then it was quite funny when you look back now and you see Glenn kicking the ball out like a goalkeeper with the most stylish kick out from, you'll see from a keeper, like the style and on the end of the swing when he was kicking it to
picking out the blade of grass that it's going to.
It was ridiculous. And we somehow managed to hold out. John Pratt comes on.
Did he have big saves to make? Can you remember?
Yes, he did, yeah. He had saves to make, come out for some crosses, which was quite intimidating when Joe Jordan has already done floored one. And then we somehow found our way into extra time. I then had cramp, like debilitating cramp. As I said, I was just over 17 years old, and every time I try to sprint, I got cramp. But we'd already used the sub, so I've got to stay on. So we're probably Glenn in goal. I'm not able to contribute too much at all. I'm sort of hobbling around, and then Ozzy gets the ball and curls one in the top corner.
Well, for anybody who's
1-0 win,
who's not seen this, what's the pitch like?
The usual, which is brown and
not the usual for now.
No, usually for that time, brown and bobbly and
churned up.
Yeah.
And the ball comes, as I remember it.
I think it must go in towards Jerry.
And the ball comes.
The ball's cleared from a court.
And it comes to the back, to the back, where the keeper's right, and it's over on Spurs' left as you're attacking. And what I remember, I've gone back and looked, because this is a goal.
Is it Ricky gets it?
Impacts on me.
Yeah, Ricky gets
at
it.
At the time. We're I don't know, because I'm that tiny touch younger than you. I'm still at school in Aussie's. Peak, and we used to, you know, shout our dealers if you got a great goal into the school, the bike shed. And so at the stage when it's on sport, I don't see it until sports night that night.
Yeah.
And I think Ricky gets it on the left. And the great thing that I like looking back at it now is that before the ball reaches, Ozzy's moving off his man, edging away to the edge of the penalty box just to create space. And if we're right, that's Ricky, which I presume it is. If Ozzy's got space, the ball goes to him immediately. And he kind of just, he
wraps his foot around it, curls it, but not without, it's not a powerful,
so sort of it's up and precise, down and curving accurate, right to left into the far corner.
Yeah.
I don't know, past Gary Bailey, who is a big, tall man, you know, to get it up and down and round, Gary Bailey from there, but on that pitch, with a wall of people in front of him.
At that stage of the game, it was late.
Sublime technique.
2 hours of football.
I don't know if it wins goal of the season or what it wins or what it doesn't, but it was an iconic goal that kind of captured.
Definitely an iconic goal.
Captured.
Then we go back to the hotel after that game because we were then playing City at the weekend.
On the weekend.
So we're staying up in Mottram Hall. It was for 3 or 4 days.
Nice.
And we had these supporters that followed the club around, wealthy supporters that wanted to join in with the party back at... So we've gone back to the hotel. We've now got dinner. It's not a party as such. We're shattered and the players are allowed to have a drink. Champagne. One of the fellas called Ricky Pross, who's a famous Tottenham supporter that followed the team around to wherever they went, pre-season tours, post-season tours, European games. Somehow he managed to get himself on the bus and the plane and he became a friend of the directors and the manager and the players, and he treated the players to a night out and he looked after them and stuff like that. He turned up, champagne for everybody, and champagne's getting passed around. So I'm a young boy and a glass of champagne comes to my bit of the table. At that stage, I'd never drunk alcohol.
Not once?
Not once. Wow. So, and I weren't particularly keen on this. I'm still sitting here, 3 games into my career, with my heroes on a table. The whole thing, I'm sharing a room with Glenn Hoddle. Glenn was my first room partner.
Your roommate, okay.
So I was T-boy for Glenn. I polished his shoes, his boots.
Does he snore?
I don't think he did. And then,
so your cup is already full of joy
exactly.
at that moment.
And we won, and then the champagne comes to, and I haven't even touched it. I'm not thinking, oh yes, big time champagne, Charlie. I'm not thinking that, but I had my hand on the glass, and I'm probably at the time thinking, if I pretend, I'll get away with this. I don't really want to drink it. I'll just knock the glass around, move it around a bit. And then Terry Off came. He was already in bed. Terry Off, he'd come in. Gone to bed, game Saturday. And he appeared, and he slumped me. He literally dragged me and threw me up to the bedroom, and he called me this, and that, about being big time, and you think you've cracked it, and you talk about put you in your place. And I didn't even have a chance to say, I didn't want it, and I haven't touched it. It was, less than that was, but to be that age and thinking...
Did you ever talk about that since? Did somebody put him up that, say, let's just... You know,
no, I'll tell you what, he came down for a glass of milk. He came down for a glass of milk.
And got clocked you, and glass, unfortunately. Clocked
me, sitting there, 17 years and 2 weeks old, playing like third game in my career, and he thinks I'm sitting there drinking a glass of champagne. And he tore into me and dragged me up to tell me what... So it was perfect. I didn't need it, to be honest, because I wasn't ever going to start...
And you've never touched a drop of milk since.
No. So the whole thing was like a real... weird, surreal part of your life, that school, playing, Man United at home, Man United away, and then it all just completely stopped.
But, you know, there's a reason for everything. So, because, you know, a life story is hard to get into one big interview, whatever difficulty there was about the leaving of your true love and ending up at Coventry, I want to hone in on, how many hat-tricks did you score in your career?
One. Just the one.
Well, this is the one.
Yeah, I know.
This is the one. Because, again, if people aren't aware, that you know, England's side at that moment and during your development as a footballer and for a good half of your career, and they're going to crop up later in your story, you know, Liverpool are exceptional. They've got a stranglehold on the title.
Europe.
They consistently win the European Cup. They're pretty damn good in...
Biggest names, best managers, best players. It was...
So how does Coventry beat them 4-0, and what's your role
in that? I don't
know.
Honestly, don't know, because it was my first game against Liverpool. It was, most of the team had never played against Liverpool. Most of us had never been on Match of the Day, and the Match of the Day cameras were at Highfield Road that day. You never knew it was on Match of the Day, even as players. So you turn up at Highfield Road, and the lorries were there, and you think, oh, we're on Match of the Day. It was...
So already you're like,
you better not... Liverpool, Match of the Day. Now, already you're thinking, that's not... Other teams that's not get hammered. We had lower league players that not played against Liverpool. We had Stuart Pearce, who just joined from Wealdstone, Mickey Ginn from Peterborough, Chura Peak from Lincoln, and Dave Bamber came from Blackpool. Myself, although I'd played those early games for Spurs, after that it was back to reserve football for a couple of years, and then a 20-game spell in the first team in my last year at Spurs. I hadn't been on Match of the Day that often either. I think I'd been on playing with Spurs, and then suddenly you're December, and we were flying as well. We were really winning games, scoring goals, bit of a surprise package because half of these players no one had known too much about. I think we were about sixth or seventh in the league. We were expected to get relegated because we had Bobby Gordon as a new manager in the top division and all these new unheard of players that went on to have really good careers. And we were 3-0 up in about 20, 25 minutes.
And look, I mean, can we describe what kind of Liverpool we're talking about? Who are we talking about, do you remember?
Well, yes. Phil Neal would have been playing.
Mm-hmm. Because this
Lawrence is Hanson.
This is a year where they're, I mean,
Dalglish and Rush.
How far off this is?
Souness
is the brilliant performance. It's not the era of the 5-0 against Nottingham Forest.
This was December 83.
So it's an era when
the era of 5-0 Forest was when we beat them in the cup final.
So we're talking about them.
This team was better than that one.
Won the European Cup in 81, and got to the final again, I suppose, in 83. So this is a group of players who have consistently been European Cup finalists or winners.
Yeah.
And so did they not turn up?
Partly. But we blew them away. We were lucky in the fact that Rob Lowe made a couple of mistakes early on as well. And that led to goals. We took every chance that came our way. Backed by a full house at Highfield Road. It was kind of the perfect... They were below par. We were playing well, confident, and played really well. And the idea was to get at them early on to see if they fancied it.
And do you remember
they did.
Do you remember your hat trick?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. The first one would have been Dave Bennett, I think, went through and a 1-2, and it never came off, and it bobbled free in the 18 yard box. And I think I slid. That was one of the goals. And I slid in and hooked it with a bit of a miss hit. Trundle past.
Talk yourself down here.
There was a knockdown in the penalty area from probably Dave Bamber that I turned and swiveled and got a decent strike on. Again, probably Robbo might have been doing better. I think Nicky Platner had bundled one in over the line as well with a shot that wasn't really powerful.
And then making this sound as if it was like, you know,
yeah,
a combination of luck and...
Oh, there was in it. Yeah,
so Nicky got the first, didn't he? Because they were Grobbelaar, Kennedy, Mark Lawrenson, Alan Hansen, Phil Neal, Steve Nicol, Sammy Lee, Graham Souness, Ronnie Whelan, Ian Rush, Kenny Dalglish, manager Joe Fagan. You were Avramovich.
Yeah, Reddy Avramovich.
Who later went on to do really well owning Chelsea. Brian Roberts, Nicky Platner, Trevor Peake. Who's the centre-half?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Sam Allardyce?
Big Sam, yeah.
Big Sam?
Yeah.
Stuart Pearce, Dave Bennett, he'd go on to have his day in the sun at the cup final, wouldn't he? Mickey Ginn, Gerry Daly.
Yeah.
What a footballer he was.
Yes,
Dave Bamber and Terence Gibson.
Yeah.
With Graeme Withy on the bench.
Yeah.
It just stuck out to me as a moment that, you know, I wanted to pick on for you because, you know, that, you know, after having felt ill-treated at Spurs and let go and unsure of Coventry in the background, having to move there, live there, buy a house, all that kind of stuff.
I thought it was an underground system in Coventry. And I thought it was I was looking for the Century Line in
And you do this. And you must have thought, like, there's proof that I'm going to make it, that I'm a top footballer.
Yeah, when I left Spurs, I was annoyed. That hence what I was talking about earlier about my love.
I fell out of love with them because
I played 20 games in the first team. When I played those first games as a 17-year-old, I got a four-year contract. When my contract ended, and I didn't play in the first team for over 2 years after those initial three games, and that's Steve Archibald and Garth Crook signed.
Mm.
So I was 17, 18, 19, I'm not going to... And the way that they performed was...
They were scoring goals,
partnership,
you were winning tournaments,
they were working, they were a duo, weren't they? Exactly, they were brilliant.
Yeah.
But in my last year, I got back in and played 20-odd games. And then was offered a one-year contract with a 50 quid a week rise. And that was done through the post.
Mm.
And I just felt that I wasn't being treated accordingly for someone that had played the last 20 games of the First Division season that year. To open the post one morning and take it or leave it off of 1 year and 50 quid a week rise.
But the Coventry experiment...
I went to Coventry for three years.
It's fantastic.
Less money.
Less money, but playing.
Yes, and playing. I felt wanted at the Coventry. Well,
you know, we sat recently over in Dublin with Robbie Keane, and, you know, he left the club he loved in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And he talked about not having regrets because although he'd wanted to have the success he's had in other places there, and that was the team that mattered to him, he didn't have regrets going back because it was only about playing.
Exactly, yeah.
And every time he's moved, it's because he feels he's not going to play enough and he could play more another game and that the money comes, but playing is the thing. And that's part of what's driven you throughout your life. And it's part of what, because you 50-something goals in a couple of seasons at Coventry. And United pick you up. And I'm interested about the United. I want you to paint pictures of the two Uniteds you saw.
I had this idea that I was going to leave Coventry because I was, you say, 52 goals in 104 appearances in 2.5 seasons. And the last half of the season, the speculation was I could have gone, nearly came back to Spurs. They sold me for 70,000, didn't want to pay the 250 at one stage that it was to get me back. Peter Shreves had become manager. It was his idea to get me back, so I was keen on that, of course, but that didn't happen. And then the more goals I got, the higher the price went, so the less chance of going back to Spurs. And I kind of knew that United were interested. And then I had a phone call from a former Coventry teammate who was now at Manchester United to ask Bryn Atkinson. Peter Barnes said, Ron wants to know, would you be interested in coming to Man United? Yeah, of course. So it was... At that stage, I feel it now, it was justified. Me moving to a club, starting my career at Spurs, decent goal scoring record when I was played in the right areas of the pitch, proved myself at Coventry in a relegation threatened team for two seasons. We survived on the last day of the season, 19 goals in those two seasons, then 14, I think it was, in half a season, again, in a team that was fighting relegation. 14 goals was harder than any of the players' tallies at Old Trafford when I joined them. It was the season they'd won the first 10 games of the season, and looked like they were going to win the league. By the time I joined them in January, it was highly unlikely they were going to win the league. They still had a chance, but it wasn't likely. So I probably joined a team that had peaked that season.
Set the scene, who's the coach?
Ron Atkinson. Mm-hmm. Ron bought me. And I was kind of... feel aggrieved that I never got the chance that I should have done. I went there full of confidence. Then, with United still having a chance of winning the title for the first time in well over 20 years, and my goal scoring record that season in a team that didn't create as many chances as Man United would was far better than the players that were already at Old Trafford, who were struggling with confidence and stuff like that. I got thrown in against Liverpool for my first game within a week of joining. Say thrown in, you know, away to Liverpool. We drew 1-1 and that was it to the end of the season. Another player, Peter Davenport, was signed. Mark Hughes was still at the club. Frank Stapleton, Mark Hughes left, was going to leave in the summer to go to Barcelona. By the time we got towards the end of the season and I played at Newcastle with my first game. It was my second game for the club, but 3 months apart, probably longer than the other one. And we were 3-0 up, I think, before I seriously injured my knee with two or three games to go that season. So it took me a year to make my home debut. Mm-hmm. I never played for United at home with Ron as manager. So it doesn't take long. And it still happens now. And I have a lot of sympathy for players that go to new clubs that don't make an immediate impact through no reason of their own, are then written off. And then constant speculation they're going to be leaving. So before I'd settled in, before I'd played a home game for the club, I was on this list of players that were going to be leaving the club without hardly ever getting a game. And I see it time and time again now. So I will stick up for the players that we talk about on our Spanish football. Mm-hmm. Zaza was one. There's one me at Real Sociedad. I see one me flop at Southampton. Didn't score in 22 appearances. He started two games. Mm-hmm. So you have to give people... a chance. You can't just say.
So put flesh in the bones of what you've talked about.
So I was pissed
because
off,
you're talking about a human being's self-regard and confidence, and you know, irrespective of your level of talent, if the mental side, the application, the self-belief, the willingness to take risks, the willingness not to hide, all of these are eroded if you feel that the person who's employed you isn't interested or doesn't want to give you a chance.
And
is that right?
There's always a mystery about it as well. I went and saw Ron on a few occasions and he kind of waffled on. He didn't really give me an honest answer. And then apart from one day, he said to me, I signed the wrong player from Coventry. I should have signed Cyril Regis. Yeah, by all means, make a choice. There's no comparison between me as a
difficult
player
mistake to
and
make,
Cyril as a player. It's totally different. And so he was just being flippant. He was trying to be clever. It didn't help, and I was sub one game, and I'd been sub for a few matches, and he said, I was actually going to the toilet before the game in the changing room, and he come up, and he was going to the toilet, he went, do you know why have you a sub, kid? So I said, no. By that time, I wasn't really, I could have been clever and said, I'm playing a few different positions, I can quick. So I said, no, and he said, because you're a lucky mascot. So I thought, cheers, that's that, so I'm not going to get on, and if, yeah. So it kind of, you can tell to this day, it's still rattles me cage that you go there full of hope, full of confidence, and in the way that someone can manage you and respect you can totally.
It's a cheap way to treat another human being, really, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. And it was no explanation for it. It was just weird how everything went so south so quickly without any obvious reason.
Paint the picture of what the environment was like around you, though, because unfortunately, because you were either rehabbing or waiting for your chance, you were a witness to.
Yeah, the rehabbing was ridiculous when you look back now, but I think it was about three games to go before the end of the season. I had surgery on my knee, I had to have further surgery in the summer, and then I was expected to return back pre-season on my own accord, fit enough to train again. And I did. There was no physio, there was no rehabilitation at the club. It was
just get on with it.
Yeah, come back and see if you're fit for day one of pre-season. Which is bizarre. I was running up and down hills and doing what the surgeon told me I could do and couldn't do. And then you turn up at pre-season and that was it. Off you just had two operations on my knee in the summer. Again, that's just for the listeners how the times have changed now. And then I went back pre-season and the same thing continued. I got a game at Leicester. We were in the relegation position just before Ron got the sack.
Manchester United, right?
Yes, and we hadn't won. I got another game at Leicester. So now my first three games have probably come about 6 or 7 months apart. They've all been away from home. And then we got a draw at Leicester. First points for a few games, or first point of the season or something really weird like that. And then I was dropped again the following week. And we had Southampton at home. And they won 5-0. We won 5-0. It was always going to be an easier game than the one the week before, the ones the week before that, where the confidence was going away. We get a good draw at Leicester, and then I'm thinking, I might get a game against Southampton, who were another team that were probably struggling at the time below us or something. And it 5-0, and I was back on the bench.
But what was the regime like? What was the regime like? Because what's emerged now is that the new regime, which we'll talk about in a minute, came in and found slackness and decay and players who were drinking or players who were kind of allowed to do what they wanted to do. The Ron Atkinson, he strikes me as somebody who had his mind on greater things or on himself or whatever, but it wasn't the right regime at a big football club?
Yeah, no.
Or is that unfair?
No, it's not. It's, as I said, I think that team peaked that season. You know, they won the first 10 games. They were flying. And then when I look back now, the players never were the same again afterwards. You know, the core of players that were going to have to be changed. It was slack. I mean, I'd been brought up at Spurs and then gone to Coventry. And the same principles were there in place. So it was unusual to see. And then when I went to Wimbledon, the same principles applied. It was only when I went to Manchester United and people could drift out and train when they wanted to. The manager could drift out and train when he wanted to. For instance, a perfect example would be travel down to London for a game with Coventry or travel up north with Spurs and stay in a hotel overnight. There would be a set dinner time at 6 o'clock. There would be a menu that you could choose from. It would be super melon, chicken or steak. It was the same for both teams. When I went to United, my first trip down to London, we stayed in the Royal Lancaster Hotel. I'm sharing a room with Mickey Duxbury. And I've said to him, what time's dinner? He went, well, what do you mean, what time's dinner? I said, well, don't... He went, no, just there's four or five different restaurants here or we can order room service. So, oh, strange. So we ended up, as you would, totally abused. We had a big strawberry gâteau and a big strawberry milkshake and steak and Dover sole and lobster. And it was just with normally.
No, I remember team unity, no structure.
No structure, no community. Team community. I remember Jerry Daly, going back to Jerry, ordering a prawn cocktail. The choice at Coventry was super melon, chicken or steak, and Jerry fancied a prawn cocktail. And Bobby Gould, Torrington, called him a playboy. And Jerry had to pay for his own prawn cocktail. So now, because where did Jerry come from?
United.
Yeah.
United.
So it was like, yeah, use the phone, don't have to pay the bill at Coventry.
Never.
Yeah, use
so or phone home or
phone. Phone wherever you want. So we now, we get to the hotel in London about 4 o'clock and we're leaving at midday, 1 o'clock the next day. We don't see each other until that time. So you've had dinner, breakfast, everything's room service. The big tray's coming into your room on the trolley with a big silver platter thing on top with your lobster and prawns under it. And then at the end of it, Mickey Duxbury empties the entire minibar into his bag. And Mickey's not even a drinker. And I said, what are you doing? He went, oh, this for the lads, the drinkers, on the way home on the bus. So I said, no charge. Oh, no, of course not. So then, of course, on the way back, driving up north the following after the game with little miniatures from the minibars. That was that. So it was the Coventry and the Spurs thing was similar. So that was an example.
That's a shock to the
how
system.
Different things are.
That has to breed slackness. If there are no rules and you can kind of do what you want, no matter what kind of pro you are, subconsciously, it's a laid-back atmosphere. You know, defeat and victory must be more similar bedfellows than victory is routine and defeat is a disaster. No, if that atmosphere is so slack.
Clearly it was different because it wasn't like it at Spurs. It wasn't like it at Coventry. Yeah. It was just like it. Now, whether it had always been like that on the run, I doubt it. I probably don't think it had because he'd had success with a group of players that had grown with him, like Norman Whiteside and Paul McGrath, and probably the whole thing became a little bit too comfortable in terms of team selection, people fighting for a place they didn't have to. There was a group that were Ron's friends as much as anything else. So it was different.
You're not the first. And in this series of podcasts, again, we had a lovely time with Charlie Nick, who explained why Arsenal in the, you know, Kenny Dalglish and Souness were saying to him, Liverpool's the place for you, Liverpool's the place for you. His agent took him to United and they sat down to lunch, or dinner it was, Ron Atkins and him, and Ron took a pendant from his chain around his neck and took out his gold toothpick and started picking away while Charlie and he were talking about it. And Charlie says now he's looking at him going, nah, you ain't for me, mate.
We had the talking about old training grounds, the Cliff. I don't know how that worked. Because the Cliff goes back years, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Cheltenham, it's one pitch.
When we were up there last season with Quinton Fortune, watching under-16s play, filming a documentary.
Yeah, we used to have a triangle behind the Cliff, and they called it Wembley. And it was a little triangle with a goal on. But no resemblance to, the grass was never cut, it wasn't the type of surface for a football pitch. But it would be a little area where you could go and practice a bit of shooting with a goalkeeper that was a field next to the pitch. It was called Wembley. It was taking a piss, I guess, calling it Wembley. But it was a little triangle that you could go up and it was no size whatsoever either.
How did Manchester United, we know now,
I don't know,
allow that to have been the case for so long?
I don't know. I think I can remember first team and youth team in half a pitch and first team and reserves in half a pitch each doing training sessions or someone running around the pitch waiting to train by one training pitch.
And Ron was always there or something?
Yeah, Ron's office overlooked. And Mick Brown would come. It was some mornings in the winter, middle of winter in November, January, February, March, December. The old sun lamp would go on in Ron's office and Mick Brown would say, oh, Gaffer'd be out in a minute. So we've got to wait because Mick didn't fanny about why the sunbed finished and then Ron would come out and same training every day, bit of bump, diddly bump, quick blast on the banjo and some happy feet to finish.
What?
Exactly. I think bump, it was shooting practice, father side and some sprints.
But they were called?
Bump, diddly bump was the shooting practice. So he would come out and write, okay chaps, we're going to have a bit of bump, diddly bump. A quick blast on the banjo.
Which one?
And some small-sided game. And then some happy feet to finish, which would have been sprints. And that was day in, day out. Nothing to do with the game before. nothing to do with a game that's coming up. It was literally a quick blast on the banjo, a quick bump, dilly bump, and some happy feet. It was every single day. Because no one knew who was playing, although they all knew who was playing. There was no organisation, there was no planning for the next game, there was no team shape, there was no tactics. It was just the same players knew that they were playing, and it, you know, unless...
Because that wasn't affection, you know, because you smiled for the first time, because you were not...
Oh, no, as a player, you loved it. It was all you wanted to do. There were three things you wanted to do. Shooting practice, a bit of a keep ball session or a small-sided game, and some sprints. But it was not conducive to organisation and winning games of football.
No learning from the last mistakes of the last game or what. So the new broom. Look, you're going to last, you know, to the end of a season with Sir Alex Ferguson, Fergie, then. Yeah. But one... Who the hell was he when he was... I know. I grew up in Aberdeen.
Yeah, yeah.
He was everything to me and people
like
me.
You know, I knew who he was. I wasn't daft. I was a big fan of...
But impact-wise, I can't imagine that people were going, no, well, hey,
when he
Alex
got it,
Ferguson.
Gordon Strachan said, oh, that's me, fuck them.
Yeah, they...
And then Gordon told us... He didn't tell us what happened, but he told us what to expect. And at the time, yeah, it wasn't a massive name. It wasn't a surprise. He'd been linked for a job. There was speculation that Rob was on borrowed time. So he was the name that kept coming up, with knowing about his success at Aberdeen. And any manager that walks in through the door, the first thing a player wants to do is a first impression and impress and hope he fancies you. Hence the reason Gordon said he knew it wasn't going to work. They're obviously saying it happened. And
regular things.
Yeah. It was... Yeah, I didn't really care. I was just glad of impressing someone.
What did you notice?
There was an instant.
Tell me
our first away trip was, funny enough, place where I ended up living, where I'd lived before, in Epping, little post-house hotel. We were playing West Ham. It was the sensible place to stay. It was near to Upton Park. It's not a great hotel. It's still not a great hotel. But Manchester United stayed there because it was convenient. And the first night that... away trip was super melon, chicken and steak. It was, and there was a meeting time for dinner. Yeah. There was a meeting time.
And you ate together?
And a meeting for the next day. Yeah. We ate together and everything was back to normal again. There was No, they were empty.
Already?
They were emptied. Yeah, they were emptied. So there wasn't even the
temptation. He's never been a fan of players drinking.
Yeah. Why?
Never.
Yeah, boy, it shouldn't be a surprise, you do.
Training ground, what did you notice? Because my imagination tells me that you're there, age 24-ish.
Yes.
And going, right, the banjo player's gone, there's my chance.
Well, the treatment room overlooked the pitch as well. So for 3 days in a week, half the first thing would be watching training through the window.
Mm.
And then turn up on Thursday and Friday and play Saturday. So that changed, that treatment room cleared out because a new manager. And then we suddenly have the...
Just pause there. What do you mean that, you know, the room cleared out? What, he's a Lazarus? Or he touched them and they were healed? Or?
Yeah. No, no.
Explain.
No, they knew they couldn't get away with what had been going on before.
Because you could just go, I've got a twinge, I need a raw, but I better not train.
X-ray was right down, a long road down, wasn't it, getting an X-ray if you had a problem up until...
So you could just swing the lead if you wanted to.
It happened to a lot of clubs I was at. Yeah. There was players that
particularly if you're a senior player and you said, I'm not right, and you could take a quiet day off in the warmth.
Yeah, yeah. That cleared out, so everybody was miraculously recovered and fit and raring to go. And then instead of ambling around waiting for the manager to come out or players to come out and train, it was from day one, he read the rule book.
What were the rules?
All the same rules that were at Spurs and Coventry.
Ah.
So it was just normal
timekeeping
procedure. Oh, yeah, exactly. The basic requirements that were expected everywhere and probably were. And so it was timekeeping. It was particularly with regard to training. You had to be out when he came out. So he didn't want to be coming out and, where's so-and-so? He's just pulled up and he's up in the treatment room getting a strap in. It was 10:30. Might be 10 o'clock, 10:30, but it was 10:30. He was out at 20 past, and at 10:30, we would be the start. None of this.
You must be there and be ready.
Yes. So, and then he had the squares painted out.
This, you know, this gets me going because Michael Carrick sat down and gave a brilliant description of what you and I know about the power of the rondo in Spanish football, and you know how it's some of the beauty of what we see, never mind the successes, is attributable to the work they do in the rondos and the chase ball in the middle. For anybody who doesn't know, one or two in the middle, six, seven, eight round the circle and the ball moving and blah, blah, blah. And then Michael talked about boxes, but you're saying you were there when the Alex Ferguson's first box arrived at the cliff. What is it? What does it mean? What does it look like?
It was convenient because if you had to be out 10 minutes before training started, with no balls or nothing about, you wouldn't really be that enthusiastic about standing out, would you? 20 past 10.
You're kidding.
Waiting for the manager to come out with no balls out.
Just standing around, hands in pockets.
Yeah, so all of a sudden these boxes appeared and bag of balls. And you were encouraged, without being told you had to do it, it was something to do before the manager came out that started off with, oh, what's this? And then to, in the future, becoming... get in, get changed, get out, get in the squares.
Just talk about the box.
As two come out.
Describe the box.
It would probably be about 15 yards by 15 yards.
Right.
And there would be four or five, six of them. Mm-hmm. So you would probably have seven or eight around the outside. And as people came out, they would then take the bib and go in the middle. You win the ball back. It's one touch on the outside. And then if you give the ball away, you go in the middle. And it killed 10, 15, 20 minutes. When the manager came out, if he liked what he was seeing, he'd let it go on for another 10 or 15 minutes. But it was literally something to occupy the players to, as opposed to, why am I going to stand out there? He's not out there yet.
Was it competitive or only a warm-up lark?
Mixture, really. A mixture. No one wanted to be in the middle, so that makes it competitive. Mm-hmm. But it served its purpose. I'd done it before at other clubs, but without the squares painted. Mm. So you would go out, there'd be a bag of balls and someone with a pig in the middle, you know, that sort of thing. But it'd be a circle that you would form rather than a painted area where the ball wasn't allowed to go out the line and stuff like that. So, but it was worth having because we enjoyed doing it.
I'd imagine you'd be good at the pressing at the pig in the middle. You know, being astute and quick and mobile, you know, low centre of gravity. I'd imagine you'd been good at that.
Yeah, but you didn't ever want to be in the middle. You didn't want to be the one that... You'd argue about who should go in if someone gave the ball away or someone... It was that sort of thing.
So it's a shot.
It helps your skill. I've no doubt of its value.
Yeah.
There are loads of other things you can do in it amongst it as well with another attacking player in the middle.
Yeah.
So there's different variations of it, but that was an indication from him at that time that this is how we're going to go, this is how it's going to work in the future. You're more than welcome. You didn't have to use it, but it by and large, players do enjoy, you know, not having that pressure of the manager telling you what to do, kicking a ball about and having a knock about before the real stuff started. So it got you out there. Earlier because...
It's an early sign of a culture changing. And it's a box that has lasted from that day to this and accounts for some of the passing and the pinging of the ball, first-time control that you've seen.
It's unsupervised as well, so it was almost like street football again where we didn't need referees and coaches when we were kids. You often didn't need goalposts, did you? You made your own. That was kind of how it was. This was the new thing. It's unsupervised. It doesn't need a referee. You referee it yourself. You organise who goes in the
middle. Good for spirit. Good for team unity.
Yeah, yeah.
Did anybody stand out? I'm guessing.
No.
Olsen, Strachan, Robson.
All good players, but no, there was no real weakness or strength. It was just, this is different.
No.
This is not waiting for him to come out the treatment room. The manager to get his top and his tan up. This is proper training at a proper time, appropriate stuff. Planning for preparing for games, working on mistakes from previous games. It was just the same stuff that Keith Birkinshaw did, that Bobby Gould did. It was just different, and Ron was the exception at that time at Manchester United.
It ends up not working for you to the extent that you're about to quit football. You know, big fall.
Yeah, I gave up with the whole Manchester United thing. Fergie, he gave me far more respect. He wasn't the manager that bought me, but he gave me opportunities. And when I say I gave up, that's probably the wrong phrase. I'd lost faith in the project. I pretty soon after Sir Alex Ferguson took over, I was constantly on this list of players that he wanted out. And that was a reflection on him. It was just made up list from that carried on from when Ron was manager, that the whole speculation always at United was who they were going to buy, who they were going to sell. Mm. And it was kind of, it destroyed your self-esteem to continue to see your name on a list with, you know, 10, 12, a lot of players, but the same names on it all the time. And I kind of made up my mind that at the end of the season, it wasn't for me, even though I had more playing opportunities and scored a goal against Arsenal at Old Trafford, which is, if I'm going to get the one goal against Arsenal at the Strip.
Why not against the Gunners?
It does, yes. so it kind of, but I have no complaints with how Sir Alex Ferguson treated me in his time, but it was a lost cause. I was a lost cause. The whole Manchester United thing for me was a lost cause. And I needed to get away. Oh, we fell out big time at the end.
You lost it completely.
For 24 hours. We had a game at Chesterfield for the reserves pre-season. I'd already sold my house. I was living in a hotel. I'd made up my mind I was leaving. I wanted to go, same as we talked about earlier, and play regular again. I didn't want to fanny about playing. I hated reserve football. There's no meaning to it. There was no purpose to it. No one was interested. No one criticised you, no one gave you any credit, no one cared about your results. So, and I wanted to play. I was aware that it was a short career and every single game I was going to play, I wanted it to
mean something.
To mean something. And I'd had too long on that at United, in and out, and getting opportunity here and there. And we had a reserve game at Chesterfield, so my mind's all over the place. Wife and daughter have moved back down to London, waiting for me to get a move somewhere, and this game at Chesterfield, we actually got, it was playing their first team. So it's Chesterfield first team, it's Manchester United reserves, young team. I think me and John Severbeck were the only two sort of senior players. Mm-hmm. And we got there late, stuck in traffic, literally 10, 15 minutes before kickoff. It's a full house at Salter Gate, their stadium. 12, 15,000 people, because it's
rocking, ready to turn over United.
We were, I can't remember exactly, it was a 5-4 or a 4-3. But whatever it was, we were losing 3-0 or 4-0 after about half an hour.
And what overturned it?
And came back and won.
Not bad.
So at half-time, we've had this horrendous journey. We got there late, straight onto the pitch, young team, first team opposition, men, senior players. And we came back second half and warmed up from the journey, got our legs going and ended up winning. And Fergie was there. And I thought it would have been something that he would have really have liked. The difficulty of journey.
It's a glorious Fergie Man United fight back.
And he came in and he went berserk. And he said, I want to see you all in my office first thing in the morning. And we went in and he read the right act again and said what a disgrace we were to the club, the history. He really let rip. And I, as John Severbeck, similar, exactly the same
Danish fullback.
Yeah, Danish international, he was a terrific player as well. We signed the same day and left us pretty much the same day, and we were treated exactly the same way. It was a weird situation. And John didn't say anything. And I stood up and said my point and said that I thought we deserved, the younger players deserved credit, that, you know, explained
for the
how
fight
we got
back.
There late, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we went out to hammer and tongs, and I told him he could shove his football up his arse and stormed out, slammed the door in front of all the other players and said that was it, I was jacking it in. And then I went out outside and people in the office and change rooms had heard the row. And Mark Hughes and Clayton Blackmore, my age, who I got on with, took me for a game of golf. That I didn't even play golf, but I was in this crappy hotel, wife and daughter back in London.
Pretty miserable to go back and reflect on your
row. Pissed off with Fergie.
Yeah, yeah.
So they took me for a game of golf. The story develops there. I go back to the hotel, ring Paula, my wife, tell her what's happened. She said, Bobby Gould's rang you. So I said, what do you want? And he'd just take the Wimbledon job. So I'm thinking, what did he want? I'm thinking, please. Back in London, a bloke that likes me, who bought me at Coventry, treat me well, got me playing well, had faith. So I said, what does he want? She went, I don't know. He's left a number. So I rang him and he said, do you fancy it? I said, oh,
what?
Yes, I do. Yeah, of course I do. So I said, I was even going to ring you for advice because my head's coming off. I don't know what I'm doing. So he said, look, we know we can't pay you first bit of negotiation. When he said, "Do you fancy us?" She said, make me an offer.
I'm at United, even. Bob. Yeah. It's, yeah. You know, yeah. Wimbledon, come on.
And we spoke, and he said, "How much do you think he wants?" So I said,
Fergie.
I said, "I've no idea. Don't know." So he said, "All right, leave it with me." So I went in, and I was going to do this anyway. It wasn't because there was a chance that Wimbledon were going to buy me. I slept on it, and I went in the next morning, and I said, I got in there early. And, of course, he was there. And I knocked on the door, and he said, we'd never seen him coming, because none of us got in that early. And he said, would you want... So I said, I'm coming to apologise. I was out of order. But I still stand by what I say.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.